Next case is CBT Flint Partners versus Return Path and Cisco Ironfort Systems, 2012-14-16. Mr. Josepho, when you're ready. Morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. On remand from this court, the district court granted summary judgment on a very limited basis. The theory being that the fees that senders of email pay are not paid in exchange for guaranteed delivery of emails. And that theory was flatly wrong for two reasons. First, they relied on the claim construction of requiring a guarantee that defendants don't even attempt to defend on appeal. And second, we presented abundant evidence from defendants' own documents saying that their products do provide a guarantee or assurance of delivery.
Well, they allow forwarding, which isn't necessarily a guarantee. But putting that aside, how about the advertising fee? Are there any advertising fees here, or are there just other kinds of fees?
Well, it's all of the fees are an advertising fee. The term advertising fee, the claim explains, it's a fee. You know, what is it the claim says? It's a fee in exchange for.
Well, that's what the claim says.
Allowing forwarding, right?
What is the support and the specification, and what do the defendants do?
Right. Well, the specification gives no indication that advertising fee means anything other than what the claim says.
Well, the word doesn't even appear in the specification, does it?
That's right. So it is not. It's one of the situations where I know normally you would be looking to read some other meaning into the word advertising because it's there. But this is one of these instances where the claim goes on to explain what it means. The advertising fee is in exchange for. So that's what it means. That's all it can mean. There's no support in the specification for putting any other meaning into it. And there's no other plausible meaning you could put into it. Now, they say, well, maybe it's paid something that someone pays for a subjective purpose of advertising. But interjecting a subjective purpose into a claim construction without
support. Plus, advertising fee only shows up in Claim 13, doesn't it? An added
Correct.
Claim.
A what?
An added claim.
Yes. But there's no basis for reading it the fee to mean anything other than what the claim describes it as being. And what they do in terms of their fee structure is the specification also says, in terms of the fee, it doesn't matter how you collect it, how you allocate it, how you spend it. It just matters it's the described fee. And so the fact that they call their fees different things and break them up into two or three pieces, I mean, doesn't matter to the substance of what we're talking about here. The substances are fees paid in exchange for allowing emails to be forwarded.
The claim, as you are interpreting it, seems to me to be pretty broad. Would you say that this claim reads, for example, on a system in which someone provides a service for money, that's normally why people provide services, in exchange for any form of increasing the likelihood that their email will be forwarded ultimately to the recipient?
No, I think it's more than that because, you know, allowing for...
In what respect is it limited so that your claim construction does not read on what I just said?
Sure. Well, in terms of just the plain language, right, allowing to be forwarded, right, for what you pay, you are paying for, you know, allowing email to be forwarded.
Right.
And now, the thing is...
My hypothesis is it seems to me that what your claim says, as you are interpreting, is that's all you need. Money paid and increased likelihood of forwarding the email, and you're done.
Well, what you're paying an agreement for, though, is I think actual forwarding. The point's just that in terms of direct infringement here, right? You've got a computer that's programmed to what's claimed here is a computer, and that computer is going to be at, you know, say a router, internet service provider, maybe a system administrator, something like that. You know, it keeps going downstream, and so what we're talking about is the claims computer. You know, at most, I think you could say, let's say the claims computer will allow the emails to be forwarded. And that's an incredibly valuable service because you get through that spam filter, which is a big deal to the sender of the email. But that doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to get through every downstream spam filter. And the specification makes that clear because the specification says that for any individual user, you know, the service could be activated or disactivated, which is somewhat obvious in a free society. There's no way to guarantee that any email will necessarily get through to anybody. What we do have here, though, is if you sign up for this, under the facts here, which I should explain some more, I mean, their documents are right. It's a guarantee. It's an assurance that vast amounts of your emails will, you know, not, will be allowed to be forwarded and will also actually reach the recipients because of the way they've set it up. It's the defendants did two things, right? First, they get people to pay to be on the whitelist, which is the definition of the authorized sending party. And then the other thing they've done, and the JA walks through this nicely, is they've gotten vast numbers of people to allow, of ISPs and whatnot, to allow emails to be forwarded through that. So, for example, so what it is it's a factual question, I suppose. It's not really, which in our view is not a summary judgment question, but it is. When you sign up for this, you know as a fact that you will get vast amounts of emails will be allowed to be forwarded through this. And just to give you some examples.
Well, you seem to rely on support. I think you've pointed out twice here, and I think you're referring to documents that are discussed in the brief, that there's some document that's produced by ReturnPath that says that there's a guaranteed email delivery. My understanding, however, is that involves non-accused products like MSN and Hotmail and not the accused products.
Well, no, there are two separate sets of accused products here, right? Talking about the whitelist are accused of indirect infringement.
Yeah, we're talking about direct infringement.
Well, yeah, if I can talk about indirect infringement first for the accused. Yeah. Okay, the direct infringement is limited to, that's what you want. The direct infringement is limited, it focuses on the message transfer agents, which are specific anti-spam appliances that are sold by the defendants. Now, most of what the whitelists do is not through them, which is why we have a separate indirect infringement. But for the message transfer agents, they, in the words of the claim, they are programmed to be able to query the whitelist to determine whether someone is or is not an authorized sender, which is whether someone on the list. That's the direct infringement theory. And there's substantial evidence in the user guide that they come with that, you know, program's built-in capability, which is what the claims require. That's the direct infringement theory. It's limited to those. Okay, you're talking about MSN and others. They're relevant to the indirect infringement theory against the whitelist themselves, because the whitelist, the indirect infringement theory is that it's MSN or Hotmail or, I mean, these programs have grown to the point where by the close of discovery, we were talking about, you know, according to defendant's own documents, tens of thousands of internet service providers, companies, universities were using the whitelists to check on behalf of something like two-thirds of all consumer email accounts out there. They were querying the whitelist billions of times a day, and as a result, hundreds of millions of emails were getting through that otherwise would not. I mean, that's the scope of what's going on here, which is why when I sign up as a bulk emailer, my emails really will be allowed to be forwarded. That's why they can put in their documents that it's a guarantee, because it's such a massive scale that it is. Maybe not every last one, but these are bulk emails. It does allow forwarding of massive amounts of email. And so in terms of the indirect infringement, what I was trying to get at is that it's – I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought there. On the indirect infringement, it's the MSN or whatnot that would be the direct infringer, because it's the ISP, the corporation, whatever it is, that's computer is programmed to detect and analyze the email by checking the whitelist to see whether I'm on it. That's the direct infringer, the MSN or whatever. But that then provides the predicate for our indirect infringement allegations against the whitelists themselves. So that's why the infringement structure is on the whitelists. We just have to prove for indirect infringement, we just have to prove there's some predicate act of direct infringement out there somewhere. And here we have massive circumstantial evidence of extraordinary amounts of direct infringement. And then on the direct infringement, it's just the MTAs, it's a much more limited theory there. And I could, just to explain a little more about what they do, the reason that this program is so big and really does guarantee email is that defendants, I mean, just to explain it a bit more how it works, if you look at JSA 3462 to 63, it's a confidential document, I can't really discuss it here, but it explains their business strategy for how they built up lots and lots of people who would, in fact, query the whitelist. And it's described in greater detail, let's say JSA 3244 explains it nicely by explaining that one of the keys to the rapid adoption has been the ease of use of the whitelist. Receivers download lightweight plugins for common software packages or make use of a number of spam filters that already use the whitelist by default. And what happens is, well, the receiving mail gateway will look up on sender source certified and then passes messages with positive responses upstream, ensuring that they get delivered. The reason that so many people pay for this and the reason that so many people use it is that it's an incredibly valuable service by at whatever the spam filter may be, normally an ISP or the gateway to a company or something like that, you know, screening some off, allowing others to be forwarded. That's why it has been highly successful technology. They've also made it especially easy for everyone to, for recipients of email, ISPs and whatnot, to sign up and use it. You know, by, for example, not only providing the plugins, not only letting people modify.
Is there a difference in your view between increasing the likelihood that the email will be forwarded versus, I know, you know, there's a dispute about allowing versus guaranteeing, but essentially ensuring that the email will be forwarded?
Right.
Is there a difference between those two?
Well, factually there can be, but I mean, I guess two things, right? First, if the claim construction has a guarantee in it, obviously you think, you know, we disagree with that and don't know where it would come from.
Well, let's stay away from the word guarantee then. I mean, the claim construction deals with allowing it, which, forgetting guarantee, allowing it means if A exists, B happens.
Right.
It allows that to happen.
Right. Well, remember, you enter into an agreement. I mean, there are a couple pieces to this, right? It's a somewhat odd claim because the computer is just the accused product is just a computer that's programmed to figure out if you're on the list as relevant here, period. But the reason there's more to it is that in the definition of the sending party, right, authorized sending party, it has to be someone who's entered into an agreement, right, to pay money in return for allowing emails to be operated. Now, in theory, this isn't the case at all. But, I mean, in theory, as long as you enter into that agreement, right, I mean, you could get scammed and never get a single email forwarded, but you'd still be an authorized sending party. It wouldn't be an infringement lawsuit; it'd be a fraud lawsuit. But here, I mean, none of that's the case because you know for sure when you enter into this, there's a reason the defendants can say in all their materials, you know, we guarantee, we ensure, you know, vast amounts, you know, your emails will actually get through. And the reason is that they've built up this network of, you know, standard spam software, anti-spam software out there using their product in exactly the described manner of other people using the plugin to do it. And so what you've got, and the other sites I was going to give you, just a J3244, were then J3555 and J3479, you know, where it says that bonded sender email bypasses the spam filter and goes directly to the recipient's inbox. And they've done a very good job of building up a system as sort of the third-party intermediary so that there really is, you know, as a spammer, you know, what I want is just to spam people. And for sure, you know, when I sign this up, I know that I'm going to get vast amounts of email will be allowed to be forwarded because of this. Their documents say that. The jury could certainly rely on their documents that say that. And then all this other evidence, that there's vast amounts of email, vast amounts of use of the system. And the ways in which defendants have made sure that it's true, you know, show that if they want to argue to the jury that, you know, well, they were lying when they said there was an assurance, I mean, they can. But we got a pretty good response from the jury, and it seems to me we have an overwhelming response at summary judgment.
Mr. Joseph, if you wanted to save time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Save you 2.5 minutes. Mr. Gaudet or Gaudet?
Gaudet.
Gaudet.
Thank you, and good morning. I want to start with actually a phrase from the last argument about the heart of the invention or the gist of the invention, and I think we actually have an agreement on a point here. If I wrote this down correctly, CBT's counsel's statement was that the quid pro quo is you pay money and the accused computer, quote, will allow email to be forwarded, close quote. And what he was saying is that the fact that maybe something downstream, some other computer, might not deliver to the intended recipient, that doesn't matter. We agree completely. And with that admission, the summary judgment order is unquestionably correct. The other part of the claim is an agreement.
You're saying it's a guarantee.
I'm not, Your Honor. And the district court, and not sure that matters, that word guarantee didn't appear anywhere in the summary judgment order except in the seven page, it appeared once. There was a seven page analysis. The district court quoted the claim language 12 times. The district court used the word guarantee a single time and used that word guarantee the single time. It's at JA13. I'll read the sentence. Being on the bonded sender list, however, did not guarantee that the MTA would allow an email to be delivered. It doesn't replace would allow. It's an absolutely accurate statement. If you're on the bonded sender list, it doesn't guarantee you'll be allowed.
It does seem like something of a red herring here, since at least for present purposes, I think we understand what allow means, that you blessed the email, and if somebody later regards the blessing as insufficient, or there's a problem, or there's a mechanical problem, so be it. But if the system in question blesses the email, it increases, at least theoretically, the probability that the email ultimately will be received. And that's what the invention
is about, correct?
With one nuance, Your Honor. The part that now CBT completely agrees with is it might well be that downstream something derails the delivery process. But with respect to the accused computer, and in this case that's the Cisco MTA, the accused computer will allow it to be forwarded.
Mm-hmm.
So in return for the payment, the accused computer has to allow it to be forwarded, and there is nothing of the sort in this record, Your Honor. And again, let me sort of step.
What I'm focusing on is what the claim reads on. And that is the gist of the claim, right? I mean, your argument is, and that explains why we don't infringe.
Correct.
Let me give you an example. I'm struggling with the breadth of this claim and trying to figure out just how much ground it covers. Suppose that I'm a nonprofit, and I believe there's a market out there for people who want to receive emails from nonprofits, but they don't want emails from anybody else. And you devise a system in which you say the nonprofits are going to pay me a tenth of a cent per unit of email, and I will tell you that I will screen all your emails and you'll only get emails from nonprofits. And the question is, does that infringe Claim 13?
Your Honor, I want to be sure I sort of understand where everything's happening in the hypothetical.
I think I may have gotten you playing two roles. But in other words, the accused system is a system which screens emails for the ones that are nonprofits and gets money from nonprofits in order to provide the service of screening and sends them on to people who only want to receive emails from nonprofits.
Okay, and in that hypothetical, is the accused service here happening somewhere actually on the route between the sender and the recipient, so you can control that decision?
Right.
So long as the result of paying the money is we will then allow that to get past this checkpoint, that computer, I think that would be within it.
Once we decide it's a nonprofit, and we've made that decision with respect to certain senders.
Well, no, the key decision is not that it's a nonprofit or not. It's whether or not the computer can determine that an agreement has been made to pay a fee. And I understood.
Well, a fee has already been paid by each of the people who are claiming to be nonprofits. And what the system is promising is that they will check and make sure that those are actually nonprofits, and that's what they're getting paid for.
I'm working through this in my mind, but the claim would require that computer, wherever this is happening, has an ability to determine whether or not the sender has paid a fee in return.
And the only people that are going to be allowed to pay that fee are people that have been screened as to whether they're nonprofits or not. Others will not be allowed to enter the game.
I think we need to know a little bit more about the nature of the fee. In other words, if you pay the fee, will you absolutely get forwarded? And if the answer is you pay the fee, you will get forwarded, the fact that there is an additional restriction...
Unless they discover that you're not really a nonprofit.
Right. I mean, I think the fact that there is an additional restriction, in other words, you in addition to paying a fee, you also have to be a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying
I'm not sure that anything rises or falls on that. I'm sort of
no, but you're trying to distinguish between Judge Bryson could have two alternative hypotheticals. One could be everybody pays the fee, and then subsequent to the payment of the fee, there's an additional screening, but they still keep the fee. What you're concerned about is you might be saying that they only take the fee once they've determined that you're actually not enough. That you actually are a nonprofit, right?
Right. To be sure that in fact there's a quid pro quo. I mean, this is within the specification. It's the word agreement appears seven times. It's an explicit agreement. It's on a per recipient, per email basis, and it's a very simple transaction. You pay the money, the email comes through. If the system starts with that proposition, that is to say, if you pay the money, your email will go through, and the computer has to determine that you in fact have paid that money and your email goes through. Adding an additional screening that only nonprofits are eligible would be okay. If instead the system was that that's where I'm going,
because your system has an additional step in which, in effect, it's determining this person is bogus.
But Your Honor, it's not the additional step; it's the lack of the claim step. There is nothing in our system whereby
additional step is not.
Right.
That's not a fair way to put it. But I understand it's different from the claim in your view.
And in fact, I mean, the easy way of knowing this is that these lists have absolutely no control over what happens on any computer. And the agreement, the only agreement that's in the record says that. It explicitly disclaims any ability to increase deliverability. It's the opposite of the claim. It's the opposite of a quid pro quo.
As I understood Mr. Josepher, maybe you know this case better than I, so I misunderstood, but he referred repeatedly to some sort of guarantee, and this is not with respect to claim construction because we don't want to go there,
correct,
but with respect to the accused products, right?
Correct. Your Honor, what Mr. Josepher was referring to were a number of documents where in describing the system, Iron Court or Return Path say the system will ensure delivery of email by guaranteeing compliance with certain certifications and that sort of thing. If the claim read as it reads, and at the end of it it says and thereby guarantee, that evidence might satisfy that extra element. But nothing about those documents demonstrate that there is an agreement, that there was a payment made, and that it's a simple binary thing. You pay the money, the email goes through. And nothing about those documents suggests that any completely separate non-infringement issue, the lack of any computer that ever actually allows or does not allow an email to go through based on whether or not you're on those lists. And I want to take a moment on this point because Mr. Josepher pointed out the idea of MSN and Roadrunner and said that those are the third-party computers for the indirect infringement claim. And again, somewhat borrowing from the previous argument, that position was never articulated at the district court. The only thing they can cite to is we quoted it on page 41 of the red brief at JA3741. I'm sorry. We cite this and we quote this on page 41 of our red brief. It's a quote from JA3741, which is the opposition brief to our summary judgment motion. This is the only time there's a reference to Hotmail, MSN, and Roadrunner in front of the district court. It says, in addition, the evidence to date shows that the defendants induced others, including ISPs, such as Hotmail, MSN, and Roadrunner, to use their infringing programs. Well, those are parties. That doesn't tell you what the computer is. The next sentence answers that question. For example, the user guide and advanced user guide for the Cisco MTAs provided instructions and examples on how to use the Cisco MTAs to forward email messages. There's never a suggestion at the district court that there's any computer, either directly or indirectly infringing this patent, to satisfy that computer element other than the Cisco MTA. And this, the last time that we were here, when Judge Lori and Judge Bryson in the prior appeal, that's what that whole appeal was about. It was all about the computer. This isn't sort of a minor claim element, it's a crucial part of the claim. And there was never a suggestion that any computer other than the Cisco MTA would satisfy that. And that provides, in addition to everything else I've said this morning, that's a completely independent basis for non-infringement because the Cisco MTAs don't query that list. The Cisco MTAs get information from a separate computer that you sort of think of as being at Cisco's headquarters called Cinderbase. And what Cinderbase does is it calculates a reputation score for every known sender of email on the internet. So everyone in this courtroom has a reputation score on Cinderbase from plus 10 to minus 10, assuming they've ever sent email. There are 100 different factors that go into that calculation. Until 2008, one of those 100 factors was whether or not a sender is on one of these two lists. The result of that is that Cinderbase would then give the Cisco MTA the number, plus 10 or minus 10. As the district court found, it is impossible to discern whether or not a sender is or is not on the list from that number because there are so many other factors that...
But it's conceivable that that number, being on the list, would be the what puts you over the top, right, under certain circumstances, right? If there are 100 factors, you could be number 100 and that could put you over the top.
It's certainly possible it could have that effect, but the computer, the Cisco MTA, has to make the determination of whether you're an authorized party or an unauthorized party. So the Cisco MTA that has no interaction with that list has to be able to figure out, I mean, if you buy their theory of the case, are you on the list or are you not? And it is impossible to make that determination because they don't know. All they got is a number from plus 10 to minus 10. And so, again, even if everything we said about the lack of an agreement, that there's no quid pro quo, even if we were wrong about all that, and I submit that's spot on, that's one reason that we win the case. Separate and apart from that, they have not satisfied the element that we addressed on the previous appeal, because the Cisco MTA can't do it via Cinderbase. They never accused any other computer, and on appeal, and this really wasn't any part at all of the district court case, they've now said, well, the Cisco MTA could be reprogrammed to query the botnet sender list or the sender certified list because the Cisco MTA is capable of making a DNS query. Well, I mean, every computer just about in the world can make a DNS query. That's a very generic process where you ask a third-party server, you know, you present some address and it gives you a value back. The wording of this claim requires that the accused computer be programmed to, you know, accomplish the various claim elements. And as in the Finjen case and the Fantasy Sports case, it's based on the wording of the – you look at the wording of the claims and what they're accusing. Here, they're accusing an instruction to access the bonded sender program, that list, as a thing that would infringe. So they would have to show, in using the Finjen test or the Fantasy Sports test, for this DNS query sort of fallback position, they would have to show that an instruction to query that specific list pre-exists in the software. It exists when you take it out of the box, and there is absolutely no evidence. In fact, the only evidence in the record they're citing says exactly the opposite. The user, it's not as if there's some kind of a drop-down menu and you can select it. It does not exist. The user would have to type in a command to make it go and make that query, and you know, they had all the discovery they wanted. They got millions of documents from us. They got 6 copies of the source code of those MTAs, and there's not a shred of evidence suggesting that any of that is on the system or that anyone ever did that. For the very simple – and it's logical because Cinderbase is the Iron Port franchise. I mean, it's unlikely that anybody ever would do it and reprogram the thing. But again, the record evidence shows that the computer as programmed does not do that. It does not have that instruction on it. And again, I say that, you know, this case has been going on since 2007. This case was never about that. This case was never about some prospect of a DNS query or some third party other than Cisco MTA. Those are largely the creation of very good appellate counsel, but that's not what the case was about. This case was about Cisco MTAs and about these two lists. And for two separate reasons, the plaintiffs cannot get past summary judgment on this record. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Gaudet. Mr. Josepher has 2.5 minutes left.
Thanks. Just a couple topics. First, why don't I start with the computers? In terms of the direct infringement by the message transfer agents, you know, the argument that good appellate lawyers made up the theory that the message transfer agents can directly query, and it wasn't the summary judgment brief. If you just look at JA pages 37, 37 to 37, 38, that's our opposition to summary judgment, district court brief, that made exactly the same argument. It's well preserved. Second, in terms of the content of it, the user manual, and everybody's pointing to the safeguard page of the user manual, says that you, the user, have the ability to query whitelists like bonded sender, which is names by name, and that you have the current ability to do so. Now, their argument seems to be that, well, okay, what you have to do, though, is the reason that you, using the software, have this ability is that you have to, you know, activate it, you know, specify your settings or whatnot. But that's not reprogramming, right? The code, I don't go in and change the code. I don't go in and change the programming. I just use it as intended according to the operating manual. And at a minimum, we'd have a factual question on that, too. If they really want to argue that what a user does to, according to what's described by the operating manual, is, you know, clicking on is, you know, doing this, doing that. If they really want to argue that's programming, I mean, they can argue that to a jury, but if that's true, then I programmed my, you know, I was entering code into my TV the last time I set it up. It's just, that's not the way things really work. In terms of there being none of these other computers out there, I mean, our summary judgment brief repeatedly refers to all of these ISPs, companies, universities that check the whitelist. And as you pointed out, there's 3 of them by name. Now, he's right. We didn't give like the make, model, and serial number of each computer that the ISP uses. But when we're talking about direct infringement as a predicate for indirect, I mean, circumstantial evidence that this is being done. I mean, if Roadrunner's doing this, right, if Roadrunner's checking this electronic list, the only way it can be doing it through a computer this program to do so. Right? I mean, it's sort of like, think about Lucent or whatnot. We have vastly more circumstantial evidence here. So we didn't, I mean, we didn't say, yeah, they own, this guy owns a Mac or this guy owns a PC, but obviously they're doing it with computers, and we even identified some of the people who are doing it. Also, just the massive scale on which this is going on really leaves no doubt of that. And again, this was all in the summary judgment opposition. In terms of guarantees, to go to a couple of questions, in terms of what claim construction the district court relied on, I mean, I would take the district court's word for it, and in his attorney's fees decision, he clarified, and it's much more clear than the summary judgment brief, but if anybody expressly says that, yes, I was relying on this claim construction, the CBT's construction was reasonable, and therefore no attorney's fees.
As you may or may not have noticed, Mr. Joseph, your red light is on, so we will conclude the argument and take the case under advisement.